before I introduce today's guest, I want to tell you about our one and only sponsor or advertiser. It's the Great Courses Plus. It's an app on your phone. Looks like this. For those of you watching, you just touch the app. It opens it up. And the access to hundreds of courses and therefore thousands of lectures is available for a monthly fee. If you subscribe through my podcast, that is, you go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/salon, you get a free trial. Therefore, you have free access to hundreds of courses and therefore thousands of lectures. Just to give you an idea, instead of focusing on one particular course that I've been listening to, just to give you a little bit of a sampling, Great Ideas of Psychology, Philosophy and Physics, The Dark Side of Human Nature, The Pagan World, The Pacific Theater in World War II, White Collar Criminal Law, U.S. Government, Mind-Blowing Science, This Day in History, September, recording this in September 2020, Apollo 11, Everyday Guide to Beer, Everyday Guide to Beer, Battlefield Europe, Infectious Diseases, A Field Guide to the Planets, The Science of Extreme Weather, What We Know About the Big Bang, and on and on and on. Literally, just hundreds. You just scroll through, and the beauty about this app, thegreatcoursesplus.com/salon, is that instead of purchasing a single course and then feeling like you need to listen to all the lectures, maybe you don't want to listen to all the lectures. Maybe you just want to do a sampling, which is pretty much what I usually do. So give it a try. It's, again, you go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/salon. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Gad Saad in his new book, The Parasitic Mind: How Infectious Ideas Are Killing Common Sense. Gad is a popular YouTube host, blogger for Psychology Today, and professor of marketing at the John Molson School of Business at Concordia University in Montreal, where he holds the research chair in evolutionary behavioral sciences and Darwinian consumption. He's the author of The Evolutionary Bases of Consumption, The Consumption Instinct, and numerous scientific papers, and has been profiled in the Wall Street Journal as it appeared on many popular shows. So Gad and I get into all the topics that we've often cover on this show, including idea pathogens, the origin of political correctness and how that got corrupted, identity politics, the psychology of victimhood status. Why would anybody want to be a victim? We kind of deconstruct that, as it were, including discussing deconstruction and postmodernism and what went wrong there. Social justice warriors as sneaky fuckers, believe it or not, that's a technical term from evolutionary theory. The corruption of postmodernism, what went wrong with Islam in the last several decades. The central core tenets of liberalism and free speech. The paradox of tolerance, that is to say, if we tolerate everybody, then the intolerant people will take over, and then there'll be no more tolerance. What he calls ostrich parasitic syndrome and collective Munchausen syndrome by proxy. And finally, we consider the nature of how big a problem all these ideas really are. Is this just an academic kerfuffle, or is it something much larger? And as you'll see, we conclude that it is something much larger and more important. So with that, I give you Gad Saad. Gad Saad, The Parasitic Mind, How Infectious Ideas Are Killing Common Sense. I see you have the actual copy behind you, which looks much nicer than the bound galley I got. I listened to the audio version, which, as my listeners know, I consume most of my books that way. And the reader is quite good. He does a great job. He captures your wit and sarcasm, I think, quite well. And so I know a lot of that is part of your personality, definitely comes through in this book, unlike, say, your professional scholarly papers or textbooks, which are not the same kind of thing. You do have a lot of neologisms here, so let's just start with some of these. You have, I want to go through all of these: 6 degrees of faux causality, collective Munchausen syndrome by proxy, ostrich parasitic syndrome, idea pathogens, but the title itself, The Parasitic Mind. So let's start there. What is a parasitic mind?
So as an evolutionary psychologist, one of the things that I do is, of course, study human cognition by often comparing it to other animals. This is known as comparative psychology. So I'm very amenable to comparing our behavior to that of our animal cousins. And so with that in mind, I had noticed that the field of neuroparasitology, this is the field where you study how parasites affect the brains of their hosts. It's a fantastic field laden with almost science fiction type of, not almost science fiction, science fiction type of, you know, body and mind, body snatchers. And so the classic example, which some of our, your viewers might have heard me mention before, is Toxoplasma gondii. This is a parasite that can actually infect humans, but the classic example is that it can infect a mouse. When the mouse is infected with that particular brain worm, it loses its innate fear of cats. It actually becomes sexually attracted to the cat's urine, and that doesn't lead to a good outcome for the mouse. And so taking that principle, I argue that human beings, of course, can be parasitized by actual brain worms, but there's a second class of equally dangerous parasites. I call them idea pathogens. These are bad ideas that can parasitize us and lead us into the abyss of infinite lunacy, hence the parasitic mind.
So certainly in the past, we think of maybe communism or national socialism, something like that that captures the minds of the majority of people or enough people to get power and actually cause harm. You're talking about other ideas that have infiltrated the academy. So let's just go through some of those and start with something like political correctness, which, you know, I often think of as starting off well-intentioned, say in the 1960s, and, you know, the kind of language we use to talk to other people or describe other people. You know, Richard Dawkins makes the point that you can identify when a novel was written really down to about the decade based on the language used to describe Jews and blacks and women. And, you know, when you read some of these old novels, it's you know, it's almost embarrassing. It's like, oh, my God, I can't believe they're describing people this way. We just would not do that. And it's not clear how that happened. It didn't happen from the top down by legislation. It kind of happened from the bottom up by all of us just kind of changing the way we talk about other people. That certainly seems like a good thing for moral progress. But then walk us through what happened, how it got to be to the stage where, you know, you have lists of microaggressions of things you cannot say or think.
Right. Well, by the way, your original point that it starts off from a noble, you know, cause is actually exactly the case for many of these idea pathogens. They start off with good intentions, but then, of course, the proverbial slippery slope takes you to all sorts of nasty trajectories. So in the case of political correctness, if I can continue with comparing it to animal behavior, the parasitic spider wasp is a type of wasp that looks for a spider to parasitize. It stings it, doesn't kill it, it renders it zombified, carries the hapless parasite down, the hapless spider down into its burrow, and then it lays an egg, and then the egg, as it's hatching, eats the spider in vivo while the spider is still alive. Well, political correctness is exactly the sting of the spider wasp, because it zombifies us into being quiet, slowly leading us, instead of to the burrow, to the abyss, again, of infinite lunacy. Why does it happen? Well, because at some point, it became more important to protect people's feelings than to pursue truth. So in the book, I talk about the field of operations research. So maybe I can explain it in a second and then my answer. Operations research is an applied mathematics field that tries to solve optimization problems. So, for example, there's the classic traveling salesman problem, which basically says, suppose you've got five cities as a traveling salesperson that you have to visit, and you have to visit each city once and never returning to the same point except back to point A. What is the optimal algorithm that you should pursue to minimize, say, time of travel? So optimization problems are often used in many areas of human endeavors, but certainly in business, where you're trying to minimize or maximize something. Well, when it comes to universities, the objective function that you should be trying to maximize or optimize would be intellectual growth, right? Whereas if you now have a competing optimization criterion, which is whilst minimizing hurt feelings, or minimizing hurt feelings becomes more important than pursuing truth, that's when political correctness goes amok.
Yeah. Well, let's say you're a student in an undergraduate class, you're Jewish, and one of your fellow students says, you know, don't let the kite speak, or something like that. Now, Should he be free to say that? Should the university be free to say, hey, you know, you can't talk to Jewish people that way. You can't use those words. It's politically incorrect. You know, what's wrong with that?
Right. Well, I would say, look, there are all sorts of mechanisms by which you can dissuade people from being, forgive the term, assholes, yeah, from being racist, from being anti-Semitic, right? And I think the general zeitgeist of our culture is that we have become such a society where if people actually do feel the proclivity, the desire to actually utter such, you know, racially insensitive terms, they're probably going to be socially punished. The question becomes, who is it that mets out those punishments, right? So I am someone who is a free speech absolutist. I think we might have discussed this in a previous chat we've had. So that I support the right as a Jewish person of Holocaust deniers coming on campus and spewing their nonsense. Now, there is literally, I mean, there's probably nothing that is as offensive as to deny a grotesque reality that is as documented as the Holocaust. Yet I accept that in a free society, imbeciles, racists, idiots, degenerates are going to sometimes get by our collective goodness. And so to answer your question, if I were a professor and someone uses such terms, I would take that student aside and I say, look, I don't think it is appropriate for you to be using that language. Please refrain from doing so and please be a good, polite person. But it's not for the government to decide. It's not for the university to expel them and so on and so forth.
Well, okay, not for the government. But what if it's a private university? It doesn't get government funds or not many. Or just make it the local hardware store and the owner doesn't want people – customers in there using the word kike to describe a Jew. And he says, if you use that word again, you're out. I'm kicking you out of the store. You can't come in here again. Isn't that, that's a kind of censorship, but it's the kind of censorship I think it's his right to express.
I would agree with that. Listen, we make decisions every day, either to affiliate with others or to disassociate with others. We choose a partner to live our lives with as a spouse or as a friend, depending on whether they will say kike or not, right? So again, these are part of the natural dynamics that people can assort along. It's not for someone else, a government or some, you know, imposing force to decide what is appropriate or not, because then it becomes a very slippery slope. Now, again, not to go back to the cliche, but, you know, Oriental used to be something that was fine. You could say it's an Oriental rug because it comes from the Orient, but you can't say that the person is Oriental. You now have to say Asian. Well, I consider that to be offensive because I happen to be from Asia. Why are they usurping? Lebanon is in Asia last time I checked. So when you say Asian, Indians are also Asians. But no, what we mean by Asians, we mean people from the Far East, from Korea, from Japan, from China. So this kind of language policing is frankly silly. And as someone who has experienced true victimhood in my Lebanese childhood, I find it silly that people waste so much time on this nonsense.
Yeah, but again, there's good intentions behind it because if, say, the word Oriental was corrupted somewhere along the way and became a pejorative term, then maybe you would agree, yeah, okay, let's not use that anymore, you know, like the N-word or something like that. Even when you read Dr. King's speeches where he refers to the Negro, even that's a little, you know, we don't use that word. So language is constantly changing. I was thinking about the concept of censorship when I was reading your book. Of course, you and I are in agreement on this, but just for the sake of conversation, let's say, in fact, we all censor, okay, just take the government out of it. You know, there's a lot of censorship just in your daily life. There's certain things you just don't say. You self-censor all the time. My favorite Geico commercial is the one, you know, the Geico commercials where he goes, you know, can Geico really save you 15% on car insurance? Was Honest Abe honest? And they have a clip of Honest Abe and his wife, Mary, is asking him, does this dress make my backside look large? And he's like, maybe just a little, and then she spins on her heels and storms out. You know, so I would not say yes, because she's not really asking, how do I really look? She's asking, you know, do you really still love me or whatever? She's looking for a comma. You know, so we're always censoring language. Or, you know, you can't drive through a small town at 2 a.m. with speakers on your roof blaring out some political speech because that's a disruption of the peace or whatever it would be. for the local laws. So my free speech, you know, is censored all the time, or my free speech ends at your ears if there's laws about having quiet after midnight in a town. You know, so in other words, censorship is all over the place. We're not really free to speak like we tend to think we are.
Right. So let me first address does my dress make me look like I'm overweight or whatever. I actually discuss exactly that in The Parasitic Mind. And here is, I draw the distinction between consequentialist ethics and deontological ethics, right? Deontological ethics is, I should never lie. It's an absolute, right? You should never under any circumstance lie. Consequentialist ethics puts that calculus through the prism of the consequences of the lie. So if I am going to withhold my true opinion of whether you have gained weight or not in order to save, your feelings, from stopping you from being hurt, then the consequences of that white lie are such that I should perhaps lie and not tell you that you're fat. Now, the reality is no one is always a deontological ethicist, right? And you shouldn't be always a consequentialist ethicist. What you should do is know in which case you should apply the right paradigm, right? So when it comes to certain types of lies, consequentialism is okay. For others, it's not. I think one of the things that I hope I made clear in the book is that when it comes to truth, in the truest sense of truth, then consequentialism should never win. And this is why I call myself a purist. In other words, I never sacrifice a millimeter of truth because it has some social justice positive implications. Whereas, for example, militant feminists will do that, right? We need to reject the idea that men and women have innate biological differences, because in doing so, it could stop the sexist status quo from promulgating further. Therefore, we destroy the edifice of truth in the pursuit of equality. Yeah. Yeah. No, I could chew gum and walk at the same time. I pursue true social justice while also never violating and raping truth.
Well, let's go through some of those idea pathogens you talk about in the book. Now, you just mentioned social justice, there's radical feminism, postmodernism, your death by a thousand cuts of the West analogy. So again, these start off as good intentions, you know, that, we don't want to criticize people based on their religion because look how the Jews were treated. And we're not going to do that again just because they're Jewish. So the moment somebody then, talks about Islam and, liberals say, oh, well, we shouldn't be criticizing Islam. You can kind of see the good intentions, like, because look what we did to the Jews. We don't want to do that to Muslims. So what went wrong there?
Right. Well, I think they conflated an attack on people based on their identity versus an attack based on their belief system. So if I say, I hate group X because they are group X, that's a reprehensible position. If I say group X believes in a certain set of beliefs, and I think that many of those beliefs are execrable ones that should not be in a, enlightened society, that's a completely different thing, right? So criticizing I have more Muslim friends. I get more, emails from Muslims from all around the world who support what I say than probably most people who are watching the show will ever meet Muslims, because they recognize that I don't have problem with individual Muslims. Some are very nice, some are very mean. Some Jews are lovely, some are assholes. But I could look at Islam, which is not something to be debated. Islam is codified in the Quran, in the Hadith, the sayings and deeds of the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and in the Sirah, in his biography. And so I can go to those books, and I don't have to engage in mental gymnastics and hermeneutics and say, what does Islam say about Jews? What does Islam say about, gays? I don't have to listen to Barack Obama lecture me about what Islam is or isn't. So in one of the chapters, in chapter 7 of the book, I talk about nomological networks of cumulative evidence, which is a really powerful epistemological tool, which allows us to answer a question by trying to identify as many distinct lines of evidence that points to one incontrovertible conclusion. So maybe Islam is the most peaceful religion in the world. Maybe it's the most violent in the religion in the world. But I will let the data decide that. I won't let my emotions and my hysteria do that.
Yeah, I love that chapter because I like that whole convergence of evidence, as I call it, or William Ewell called that the consilience of inductions. Independent lines of inquiry pointing to the same conclusion strengthens our confidence in that conclusion. So with Islam, part of the problem is, you know, asking the question, is it a religion of peace or is it a religion of hate or whatever? That's too black and white. That's too categorical. You know, it's, you know, when you have over 2.2 billion people or whatever, you're going to have a whole spectrum across the board. So I guess what we're asking is in a fuzzy category sort of way with, you know, fuzzy on the edges, but here's a category. And it's significant enough that, I don't know, 65% of the people believe in a Sharia law should trump any kind of constitutional government of the country that's Islamic, say, then we would say, yes, that's a religion of X, something like that. So kind of walk us through your lines of inquiry of how you conclude that, in fact, Islamic ideas are essentially dangerous to Western values.
Right. Right. So I'll give you a few in the book. Yeah. I have a whole bunch of distinct lines, but, you know, I'll give you as many as you want. So I could, for example, start with the most, you know, basic analysis of the canonical texts of Islam. So hermeneutics is the approach whereby you interpret text, right? So you can use a methodology called content analysis that allows me to, well, study scientifically the content of existing text. Before I get to Islam, let me give you an example of that, say, in consumer psychology. Oh, yeah. So if I want to study, has the portrayal of women in advertisements changed over the past 50 years? Well, how would I do that? I can't do an experiment. I don't ask a survey. I don't conduct an observational study. I actually go to existing text. In this case, it might be magazines from every 10 years. So X number of magazines from the 1950s, the 1970s, and currently. And I will do a content analysis on the manner by which the women are portrayed. Now, the content analysis is only as worth as how good your coding scheme is. What's a coding scheme? So, for example, I could say, I am going to code every time that a woman in an advertisement is either shown in the kitchen or in the labor market. So it's a very clear, unambiguous coding scheme. So then I can go through these 50 years of advertisements and I could very objectively answer the question, has the portrayal of women changed in particular ways, X, Y, Z, over the past 50 years? Now let's apply that methodology to Islam. I could study the contents of Islam to tell me how often does it pontificate words of love? How often does it pontificate calls to hatred towards the kafir. The kafir in Arabic is the non-Muslim, the non-believer, right? I don't have to guess. I don't have to interpret. I don't have to listen to George Bush. I could count it. It's there, black and white. You can't say, oh, but you don't understand because you don't speak Arabic. Well, I speak Arabic, right? So it becomes very difficult for you to delegitimize it, and I can come up with an absolute conclusion. 80% of the time it says this, 12% it says that. So that would be just one line of evidence, canonical text. I could look at the number of wars there is around. So wars between Christians and Muslims, Christians and Jews, Muslims and Buddhists. So I could look at all the hotspots and see if there are any common thread that runs through all these. I can study Pew surveys that look at how do countries around the world view women, gays, Jews, atheism, freedom of speech? And then I could, and those surveys, by the way, they rank the countries on how either favorable or disfavorable they are. And I could see if there is a pattern. I could look at databases of terrorist acts over the past 20 years and look at whether there is a common thread. I could look at data that looks at converts from religion A to B and whether the ones who are converts are more likely to commit terror acts. I could look at databases from governmental agencies to see if the terrorist organizations tend to come from a particular country. I could look at the FBI most wanted list to see if they tend to come from a particular group. So I've already given you quite an insurmountable amount of evidence. And by the way, I'm not even close to finishing. We don't need to do all of them. When I put it all together, it becomes very difficult to not have a clear picture of what the reality is. Now, does that mean that individual Muslims are mean or bad? Absolutely not. Muslims wanted to kill us in Lebanon, and Muslims are the ones who freed us so that we can escape from Lebanon. So I can't conclude anything based on individual personal anecdotes. Your friend Ahmad, who is gay, loves Jews, and eats pork, is not representative of Islam. He's just called Ahmad, who chooses to avoid all those parts of his religion. Your friend Mordechai, who eats pork, is not practicing some other version of Judaism. He's ignoring kashrut laws. Okay. So again, this is a way by which I can remove myself from the natural inclination to be hysterical and emotive and simply let the data speak for itself. And by the way, as I know that you're a Darwinist, as I am, really nomological networks of cumulative evidence, as I'm explaining them here, Charles Darwin did that in proving his theory of evolution, right? He didn't collect one data set from undergraduates at Ohio State and publish the paper. Over several decades, he assiduously collected data from an extraordinary number of sources. When you put it all together, guess what? Charles Darwin is the man.
Yeah, his book is really a beautiful example of that convergence of evidence from multiple independent lines of inquiry. In fact, his correspondence, there's something like 30,000 letters to and from that Cambridge has published now, show his thinking along those lines. He's writing people in different fields all over the world and asking them about this plant or that bug or whatever, and they write him back, and that goes, and those little notes go into the Origin of Species, and he's accumulating. Now, the reason he did that was because in 1844, the Vestiges of Creation were published anonymously, which was a theory of evolution without a mechanism, or at least a viable mechanism, and the book was roundly rejected. And Darwin was already thinking along the lines of evolutionary theory, and his mentors told him, look what happened here. This guy is a laughingstock because he's got no evidence for his theory. It's just a theory without, you know. So that's when Darwin said, okay, I'm going to sit back here, and I'm going to take my time. And, you know, and he would have taken another decade if it wasn't for Wallace writing him. But anyway, that's kind of a sidebar away from your book. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, excuse me for interrupting you, Michael. By the way, that's exactly the process by which I independently came up with that process of generating lines. So for those of you who don't know, the viewers who don't know, in my scientific work, what I'm most known for is introducing evolutionary psychology into the understanding of consumer behavior, economic decision-making, psychology decision-making. Now, most of the folks, and I'm housed in a business school, most of the folks that are trained, so social scientists, economists, anthropologists, psychologists, who then are housed in business schools, don't come from a biological tradition. So the stuff that I was saying was very heretical because most of them come from a social constructivist perspective. What differentiates us from other animals is that we transcend our biology, according to them. Don't you dare use evolution to explain how consumers make choices. So precisely because I knew that I was going to face and eventually faced a lot of animus from my colleagues, I developed this incredibly rigorous and disciplined epistemology. Guess what? I'm going to drown you with so much evidence that your tail is going to be between the tail is going to be between your legs, and you're going to leave the room. You're going to come in trying to attack me, but then I'm going to drown you. So in that chapter, I give examples that I've actually used in my scientific work. So for example, if I want to prove to you that toy preferences are not socially constructed, it's not because parents are sexist and they give little Johnny the toy, the toy gun, and they give little Linda the Barbie doll, and that's what starts a cascade of gender role socialization. I could drown you in so much evidence from developmental psychology, from pediatric endocrinology, from comparative psychology, all of which point to the fact that there is definitely a hormonal and biological signature to toy preferences. So in some sense, because we deal in a field that triggers a lot of emotions, evolution, you're almost forced to be a very disciplined nomological network type of guy.
Yeah, back in the 90s, I coined the term cognitive creationist when I was dealing with the regular creationists, which are mostly on the right. And then, you know, when I was friends with Steve Gould, but he had this peculiar skepticism of evolutionary psych or sociobiology. You mentioned him and Lewontin in your book. I thought, okay, he's got a bug here. It's not a feature. It's a bug in his system that's bugging him because of his Marxist background and so on. But before we get off Islam, you know, you make such a convincing argument that, you know, it's clear this is the problem today. And at the end of that chapter, I thought, what went wrong? Because, you know, had you and I had this conversation in the 1970s, we'd be talking about revolutionary Marxists as causing all these terrorist attacks and bombings and so on. There was no discussion of Islam. But Islam's, you know, it's a 1,000-year-old religion. How come now? Why has it gone off the rails today and displaced essentially secular Marxist revolutionary movements?
Well, because, look, what you just asked me, I'm going to kind of personalize it. So I often will get some people write to me and say, well, if Islam was so bad, then how come Lebanese Jews lived in Lebanon? Well, guess what? We lived in Lebanon until we had to run for our lives, right? You walk around looking all healthy until you drop dead of a heart attack 3 seconds later. 3 minutes earlier, you couldn't have predicted that the heart attack, Darwin forbid, was looming around the corner. So the fact that Islam may or may not be violent, and read the book to know if it is or not, doesn't suggest that Islam will be, you know, bloodthirsty every single day of the week. An analogy that I've given that wasn't in the book, if you take a serial killer and you calculate the number of days that as an adult he's killed people versus the number of days that he didn't kill people, 99.9% of the days he didn't kill people. So you don't go around saying, well, I mean, seriously, do you really think Ted Bundy is such a bad guy? Sure, he killed 100, but imagine the thousands of days where he didn't kill anybody. So the fact that Islam waxes and wanes due to various historical, theological, sociological reasons says nothing about whether its doctrines are enlightening for liberal societies or not.
Yeah. Do you have an opinion on this other question about why they hate us? So you've outlined, of course, their own arguments about what's wrong with the West and liberalism and why we shouldn't give women freedom and so on against their religious doctrines. But what about these other arguments that, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, or we have troops on their holy land, or we support Israel and that's why they hate us and so on? What about those sort of socio-political arguments?
Yeah. So this is what I call, a guy says, I committed this terror act because of my God. He quotes the 17 passages, and then some highfalutin nuanced thinker from University of Nebraska tells us that it is due to a wide range of ketogenetic, paleobotanical, sociocultural, biosocial factors. So the more bullshit you add in your that's what I call the concatenation strategy, right? I add a bunch of fuzzy terms that mean nothing to say that, you know, it could be due to all sorts of things. There is a technique in statistics called a stepwise regression. When I'm trying to predict what causes why, I could enter into the model variables X1 to X10, and then the stepwise regression will tell me you only need X1 and X5 to predict this very well. All the other ones are superfluous. They might add very little variance to the explanatory model, but it's really not worth you including it, right? So maybe the fact that Ahmed wasn't exposed to art in Brussels might have caused this, maybe. Maybe it was due to beard bullying, maybe. Maybe it was due to Israel support. Maybe it's due to U.S. foreign policy. Or maybe it's because Ahmed went to a madrasa in Pakistan, committed to that cause, and told you in a public video that I'm doing it exactly for my faith. Maybe that's the reason. No. The Western liberal professor knows better. He can read through that guy's taped confession and tell you that it was due to lack of art exposure.
Yeah. Let's hit the other big subject in that the next chapter, or maybe it was one before that, on radical feminism is yet another one of these parasitic ideas. again, you get the good intentions. Old style misogyny was that men and women are different, and women just don't have the temperament to run a company or a country. You know, they're too fragile emotionally to mix it up with men in a scientific laboratory. You know, they don't have the right kind of spatial intelligence to program computers or fly spaceships or whatever. So clearly rejecting those kinds of generalizations was a good start, let's say, in the 60s and 70s of that sort of second wave feminism. And yet somehow, again, here it's kind of gone off the rails where, you know, there are no differences between men and women. And that's the only way we can achieve parity, is if we knock down all those barriers and conclude everyone's equal.
Well, it's not only so here's exactly what I was talking about earlier. In the pursuit of a noble cause, you then end up murdering and raping truth. We could recognize that men and women have evolved to be very similar on many things and dissimilar on other things. And the only framework, the only game in town that can explain that those patterns is exactly evolutionary theory. The fact that men and women are likely to be as attracted culinarily to fatty foods makes sense, because there are no sex-specific reasons for why men would have evolved to eat high-dense caloric foods, but women wouldn't have. So when we look at gustatory preferences, we won't pick up any sex differences. On the other hand, when it comes to mating behavior, we do pick up certain differences. And these differences have been replicated in an astonishing number of cultures, which, by the way, leads to another thing that really pisses me off about the detractors of evolutionary psychology. You call them cognitive creationists. I call them flat earthers of the human mind, right? They argue that evolutionary psychology is nothing but fanciful, just so, storytelling, yeah, right? Yeah. We sit with a pipe and some cognac and we just come up with bullshit over a fireplace. The reality is that the epistemology of good evolutionary psychology is exactly opposite to that, right? The nomological network approach that I talked to you about earlier puts the evidentiary threshold much higher than the rest of the sciences. Before I can conclude that something is a human universal, like, let's say, a sex difference in human mating, I have to replicate that finding across 70 different cultures that vary on every possible dimension to show that it is a human universal. So the idea that we just pontificate nonsense while smoking a pipe is an affront to what truly happens, right? So that's the first thing that's a problem with militant feminism. But they've now gone much further. They've not only argued that there are no sex differences and everything is due to social construction, but now even the epistemology of knowing, the scientific method, is itself suspect. It's a patriarchal enterprise, right? That's why we have feminist mathematics, feminist epistemology, feminist glaciology. I mean, who knew that ice was patriarchal?
When I read that article, I thought, this has got to be The Onion, or this has got to be a Boghossian-type hoax, an Alan Sokol-type hoax. And so I actually contacted the university, and they go, no, this is real. I'm like, okay. Yeah.
So I'll tell you a story, and I don't know.
Yeah, go ahead. I was just going to say, if you can't tell the difference between the fake paper and the real paper, then what are we talking about here?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, by the way, the Boghossian stuff, as before it had come out, some of us knew about what was happening. Now, at one point, I had seen a paper. And I contacted Boghossian, not knowing whether that was him or not. And it was just like a very short text. I said, Boghossian, is that you? And he cracks up laughing. Yeah. So that's the incredible thing of many of these grievance studies, because you really truly don't know if they're satire, if they're real, if they're fake. But by the way, the postmodernists have a way out, right? That's exactly what they did with Sokal, right? For your viewers who don't know the Sokal story, let me just briefly summarize it. Alan Sokal is a physicist who decided to write a hoax postmodernist article on gravity and social construction of gravity and all this kind of stuff, which was accepted in a top postmodernist journal. And then he admitted to his hoax. And then the response was, oh, but that doesn't prove anything, because we could extract meaning from the article that is idiosyncratic to us. So then how do you falsify that it's bullshit, right? That's the beauty. It's like, It's like when you are trying to falsify the efficacy of touch healing, right? If you falsify it, as a young kid has done and published a paper in JAMA many years ago, I think she's the youngest author to ever publish a paper in JAMA, Journal of the Academy of Medicine, whatever, Association for Medicine, and so on. They said, oh, the reason why the touch therapy didn't work is because you're putting it through the rigor of the scientific method. So it's affecting the energy fields. I mean, no one knows this kind of argumentation better than you, right?
Yeah, that was Emily Rosa. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great story. Right? Her mother is a nurse, Linda Rosa, who was watching one of these videos of these therapeutic touch practitioners one day. And Emily was 10 at the time, and she had to do her fourth grade science project. And she was going to do this one thing. She said, I think I'll put this to the test. And so it's a beautiful example, because she wasn't testing, does it work? Because what do you mean by work? How do you operationally define work? I felt better, or my headache went away, or, you know, my arthritis attenuated. You know, she doesn't have time for, you know, a 6 month or 2 year epidemiological stay, whatever. She just wanted to know, could they detect the human energy field, full stop? And they couldn't, you know, beyond chance. Exactly. So if you're not detecting the human energy field when you say you're manipulating it, then what are you doing? Anyway, I love that story. You know, as a good example, you don't need particle accelerators, $1 million grant from the National Science Foundation. You can do it with a cardboard table and a piece of cardboard.
And I'm going to add to what you just said, and it demonstrates how the scientific method is truly liberating, not only from our individual identities. There is no Lebanese Jewish way of knowing. There's just knowing. There is no indigenous way. So that a 10-year-old, as long as she assiduously follows the protocol of the scientific method, could herself be a participant in science, and she could publish a paper in JAMA. I mean, what could be more liberating to the human spirit than that? It creates true democratization of knowledge.
So the two core themes of your book are freedom and truth, and that universities have kind of lost their way. You did a little informal survey of the number of times the word truth, usually in Latin, appears in the motto of the university, and yet a lot of them seem to be moving away from that toward this kind of social justice. These terms alone have been kind of hijacked. I mean, if you ask me, are you in favor of social justice? Well, of course I am. You know, do you think Black Lives Matter? Of course I do. But that's not what actually is being asked. You know, do you believe in this particular political movement that we happen to be calling social justice movement or the Black Lives Matter movement? It's like, well, what's entailed? And then you list off all the things. And I'm like, well, no, I don't think violent rioting is a way to, you know, whatever. Anyway, so you make this point that this kind of the hijacking of certain words, you know, do you believe that women should be treated equal? Of course I do. But then it usually involves something radically different than that.
That's the beauty of nefarious marketing, isn't it?
Well, but your point is that these kind of pathogenic ideas are designed in a way that you can't criticize them, because if you do, that means you're exactly. against freedom, you're against equality, you're against women or against blacks or whatever. So it's a protective shell around them from Popperian falsification. How do we know it's true? I want to challenge you. You can't challenge it.
Well, and that's so. I've got a section in the book where I talk about the section titled "All Roads Lead to Bigotry."
Yeah.
Right. And where I show precisely using the principle of, so for those of you who don't know, Karl Popper was a philosopher of science. And, you know, one of his great insights is that science has to operate through the falsification principle, which basically means what? In order for something to be within the realm of a testable scientific theory, there has to be a pattern of data that can falsify it. If you could never do that, then it's not within the domain of science. So take, for example, the concept of destiny. Well, if I now walk out of my house and I'm not hit by a truck, well, that was my destiny. If I walk out and I am hit by a truck, well, that was my destiny. So all roads lead to the instantiation of my destiny. So I can't test otherwise. So it doesn't fall within the falsification rubric that Popper so elegantly explained. So now we come to all roads lead to bigotry. If you ask me, are you attracted to a particular type of woman? And I say yes. And you say, what type of women are you attracted? Well, I find black women to be very beautiful and exotic. I love their body types. I find them very intoxicating. Well, you're a bigot because you are objectifying the black body. and you are using certain schemas and archetypes to sexualize the Black female body. If you ask me, well, do you like Black women? And I were to say the exact opposite now, right? Well, actually, I don't find Black women attractive. I tend to like Lebanese women. You're a sexist bigot. Actually, they call the term sexual racism right. Because if you write in your dating app that you only want to date this type of race, well, then you are a sexual racist. So if I am attracted to Black women, I'm a bigot. If I'm not attracted to Black women, I'm a bigot. You could apply the same logic for, say, transgender people. If I am a heterosexual male, therefore I like to mate with women who have vaginas, not 9-inch penises, who call themselves women, then I am a transphobe. If I say, actually, I'm turned on to date transgendered women, well, then you are fetishizing transgender people. So no matter what I do, I'm a Nazi bigot. And you could apply it again for women, for example, who are overweight and so on, right? So therefore, what happens is the calculus is set up in such a way that all roads lead to bigotry. There is no way for me to extricate myself from the final appellation of me being a Nazi bigot. And let me maybe mention one or two other examples within that frame. A student at Queen's University, and I discuss this in the book, I'll give two other examples from the book. A student from Queen's University wanted to demonstrate that Canadians are vile Islamophobes. So she donned a hijab for 18 days to see how people would respond to her. And to her surprise, and undoubtedly to her disappointment, she found that Canadians were incredibly gracious, kind, and polite to her. Now, did that falsify her premise that Canadians are Islamophobe? Oh, no. Their latent hatred of Muslims caused them to overcompensate by being so kind towards her. And I'm going to leave the last one, the best one for last. A Jewish doctoral student at Hebrew University, a diehard liberal, bleeding heart liberal, you know, let's hate ourselves Jew from at Hebrew University, wanted to demonstrate that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, were engaging in rampant rape of Palestinian women. So she goes out to study that, and she doesn't find a single case of sexual assault from IDF soldiers on Palestinian women. Did that resolve it, that they are really good guys? Absolutely not, Dr. Shermer. It demonstrated that those Jews are so disgusting, they so other the Palestinian women that they weren't even worthy of being raped. I wish I were being satirical, but I'm not. That's what the book is about. Idea pathogens can remove the capacity to engage in human reasoning.
Yeah, and it just leads to the silencing of anybody. I mean, the way you describe that, if somebody asked me if I'm attracted to Black women or not, I just wouldn't answer. I'm afraid to even open my mouth, because either way, you know, I'm a bigot. So what's the point? And that's what you're talking about there. That kind of censorship is actually even worse or more dangerous than what the government could do, or at least in the same category. Let's talk about, what do we want to talk about here? I love the section on social justice warriors as sneaky fuckers. and we don't have to label this podcast as explicit, because that's an actual technical term from biology, evolutionary biology.
Yes. So that came up in the 70s, where various animal behaviorists and zoologists found that there's something called sexual mimicry, right? Or kleptogamy. You surreptitiously steal a mating opportunity by pretending you are something else. So you see it in some fish, you see it, in various animals. And so as an evolutionary psychologist who looks at other animals to study their behavior to then draw parallels with humans, I said, wait a minute, it seems, and actually one of the first times that I publicly pitched that idea, I think one of the first times, was the first time that I had invited Jordan Peterson to come on my show. This is about 4 or 5 years ago. And there's a great clip that people, you know, has become viral all over the internet, where I pitched the male social justice warriors as sneaky fuckers to Jordan, and his reaction was really delightful. He just starts cracking up. You know, Jordan can be quite a stern sort of figure, and that really, you know, got to him. And so basically what I argue is that male social justice warriors are engaging in this sneaky fucker strategy. What they're basically doing is they're demonstrating how sensitive they are, how sweet they are, so that they can... Navy SEALs are usually not social justice right. warriors. In other words, their morphological features signal otherwise. Yeah. And in the book, if you remember, Michael, I go to movies to come up with examples of classic movie character that are, and the classic one is in the movie Pretty in Pink in 1985, I think, where there is this famous character, Ducky, who's hanging around this girl all the time, being kind of like a hapless, sneaky fucker. Hopefully, if I'm nice to her and she steps on me long enough, eventually she'll give me a mating opportunity. Well, that's exactly what those male social justice warriors are doing. And by the way, I was going to empirically test this mm-hmm. idea with one of my graduate students until the goddamn coronavirus came along. And so, because we were going to collect salivary assays to measure the testosterone levels of people as they answered these surveys, so that hopefully we can establish that there are some physiological and morphological differences between male social justice warriors and non-male social justice warriors. But it doesn't look like the study is going
to
happen anytime
soon. Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, I'd love to see empirical testing of that. That's been my intuition, just my subjective assessment of the people that I look at, the men that are proclaiming themselves feminists or supporting Me Too and BLM and all that stuff. Again, I support equal rights for women and blacks and so on, but we're talking about something different. And those particular sociopolitical movements seem to be supported by, again, my subjective observations, beta males. These are men, they look kind of feminine. They're not, alpha males at all. Just the kind of their body types and their, the way they dress and so forth. But I wonder if I'm just, confirmation bias or so it'll be great if you can actually put that to a test of some kind.
Stay tuned.
So let's talk about ostrich parasitic syndrome and collective Munchausen syndrome in the context of, I guess, this victimhood status. What is the psychology of why anybody would want to be a victim?
So let's start with the collective Munchausen, and then I can do ostrich parasitic syndrome. So in 2010, I published a scientific paper in a journal called Medical Hypothesis, where I was trying to explain some evolutionary reasons why people might succumb to Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Let me explain what these are, and then I'll explain my malady that I coined collective Munchausen. So Munchausen syndrome is when someone feigns a medical illness so that they can garner empathy and sympathy. It's a psychiatric disorder. It's almost exclusively women who suffer from Munchausen syndrome. Munchausen syndrome by proxy is when someone who has someone else under their control, so a biological child, a pet, an elderly parent, they will harm them so that they could then garner by proxy the empathy and sympathy of having a sick child. And this, by the way, when it comes to biological children, is almost exclusively mothers who engage in Munchausen syndrome by proxy. So 10 years ago, in 2010, I had published that scientific paper in a medical journal. Now, fast forward to me being a public critic, seeing the endless hysteria of victim. No, I'm a bigger victim. No, I'm a bigger victim. No. My, right? Fake victimhood. Jussie Smollett. Elizabeth Warren, I mean, really collective Munchausen by proxy, because she is jumping on the victimhood of another, race of people to garner sympathy and empathy. So then I coined the term collective Munchausen and collective Munchausen by proxy, whereby getting the ego strokes of being a victim becomes more important than anything else. Jussie Smollett wasn't satisfied with receiving whatever it was, $1 million an episode, whatever it was. I mean, yes, he's a B-level actor, whatever, but he was a successful actor making tons of money. No, he would ascend the hierarchy by manufacturing this victimhood, because the currency becomes the most important thing is to be a victim. I tell a story in the book to to juxtapose Jussie Smollett to a personal story. You might remember this from the book, Michael. When I finished my MBA, and I was then going on to pursue my PhD, I had been invited to UC Irvine. One of the schools that had accepted me for my PhD was University of California, Irvine. So I had gone to visit there to see if I wanted to enroll there. I ended up going to Cornell. I had a brother who lives in Southern California. So my brother was trying to convince me to maybe take a break from studying, having done an undergrad and MBA back-to-back, put on the proverbial suit, get a few years of non-academic experience, and then eventually if I want to go back to do my PhD, fine. Now, I wasn't really interested in being anything other than an academic, but I went along with his wish. I hung out with him at his business. He used to be a kind of a headhunter recruiter in the software industry back before there were automatized job searches and so on. At the time, it was like literally a Rolodex thing, right? And he had made tons of money. And I come back to Montreal. My mother had heard of the fact that my brother was trying to convince me of that. She hadn't yet known that I wasn't going to not continue with my PhD. And so she takes me to another room and very, very concerned that I might not pursue my PhD. And she goes, you know, Gad, do you want, if you decide not to pursue your PhD, do you want people to think of you as someone who dropped out of school? So now imagine where our standard of excellence was set. I had a bachelor's in mathematics and computer science and an MBA from McGill University, one of the leading universities in the world. But if I stopped after my MBA, I would be bringing shame to the family. People are going to talk about us. Now, of course, I didn't pursue my PhD to please my mother. It had nothing to do with her. But that gives you a sense of the power of cultural expectations, of personal agency, be something. Now, by the way, we are the kings of victimhood and true victimhood, given our personal history, yeah. Given what we escaped Lebanon, given the fact that my parents were kidnapped and tortured in Lebanon. So despite all that, we didn't allow our victimhood, we didn't wallow in our victimhood. We were going to be something in this new land. Now contrast that to Jussie Smollett, who says, oh, I'm not really a victim, so I will construct a victimhood narrative because that's the only way for me to get my ego stroked. That's what collective Munchausen is. It's grotesque.
So, but is what the psychology behind it is getting attention or a positive affection or more likes on social media or whatever. But back to the original one, the Munchausen syndrome, and then by proxy, you mentioned it was almost all mothers in the latter one and women in the former one. What was the theory then about what of the gender differences in those syndromes?
So in the case of why it is the women more than the men, well, one of the reasons is because they're the ones who are more likely to be the caretaker of the one that you're going to, right? But also there is a comorbidity of oftentimes of people who suffer from Munchausen with other psychiatric conditions that also tend to happen more in women. And so because of these various reasons, women end up clustering along that particular psychiatric disorder. Do you want to talk ostrich parasitic?
Well, it'd be interesting to know if the people doing this collective Munchausen are on social media more than those that do not have collective Munchausen. In other words, they're getting that attention only through social media. Unlikely they're going to get it at their jobs or at family gatherings or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, before we go to ostrich, you kind of prompted something in me. So for some of your viewers who may or may not know this, one of the persuasion tools that I use in my arsenal of persuasion toolbox is satire, right? Because I use that as a very powerful way to demonstrate some of the grotesque lunacy that takes place. So I have many different lines of satire, one of which is I have a series where it's hiding under the desk series where I am so afraid of something and I hide under the desk. Now, where that came from is precisely from seeing the astonishing, the laughable, the embarrassingly laughable collective Munchausen I would see even in my personal Facebook page. So when Donald Trump was elected president in 2016, now these weren't some quacks on my personal, these were oftentimes, you know, female professors, right? And they were all so afraid to go to campus tomorrow because I am a woman of color and I don't know if in some rural campus in University of Maine, it will be safe for me to go to campus, right? Because the day that Donald Trump was inaugurated, he was setting up roadblocks where, you know, white males can go to the right and to the left are all the women of color who are going to be gang raped by his, you know, death militias, right? So the reason why it angers me and it triggers that ire in me, well, first, because I'm a purist for truth, but because it really offends my sensibilities as a true victim, right? I have seen what it is to have nightmares for 25 years after escaping Lebanon. And I discussed this very briefly in the book where I talk about two of the recurring nightmares I would have is that there are bad guys coming into the house to take us and I have a gun, but then I run out of ammunition, or the gun locks and then I wake up in a complete panic, right? So when people come from environments where they literally didn't know if the next second they were going to be alive, and they have all these hysterical schmucks who don't appreciate the beauty of the United States. Now, this doesn't mean that the United States is perfect. It doesn't mean that it hasn't done bad things in the past. But in the grand collective memory of the human experience, the United States is something that you truly want to consider as laudable. But they're so desperate to be victims that they start reinforcing each other. I hear you, Janice. Me too. I'm scared. I'm so terrified. And I find it so disgusting and so grotesque that's how I then mock it and satirize
it. It's an interesting technique. I have no idea if it affects people that actually think along those lines. I'm curious why you think they do. Is it something in their background? I mean, why is everybody not like Jocko Willink that just say, buck up and do more burpees and be a man, grow a pair, or what do you call it, testicular fortitude? Some of us do feel that way. Others just don't. And I don't know if it's their background or it's part of their big five personality, just, you know, temperament or whatever. Maybe there's some more empirical research for you there. I went to a safe space meeting a few years ago at the university where I teach. And it was, you know, mostly an LGBTQ thing. And because I was curious what it was all about. And they were mostly just kind of complaining about assholes that made remarks about being gay. You know, like, for example, one guy was saying he was walking along the sidewalk on the fringes of the campus with his partner holding hands, and some guy in a pickup truck, as you might predict, you know, made a remark, you know, something like fucking gays or, you know, faggots or something like that. And I'm just thinking, yeah, okay, so, I mean, there's assholes. That's just the way it is. You know, I'm a cyclist. I ride out a couple hours a day on the roads, and inevitably somebody drives by and says something to me, and it's like, yeah, fuck off, asshole, you know, and I just blow it off. So and without denying anybody's actual victimhood status or not even evaluating that, I guess the question is, so it's true. Now what? What are you going to do with that? And so one of the points of your book is that, you know, nurturing a victimhood status corrupts your ability to think clearly or move forward with your own life to make progress and meet your own goals if you're wallowing in that kind of victimhood status.
Exactly. And to use a term that, I mean, the term might have been introduced by your very good friend, Nassim Taleb, but anti-fragility is a concept that it's not him who coined it, right? I mean, the truism, squeaky doors don't break, refers to the fact that you need to have resilience, a system that is anti-fragile, that doesn't break up the second you give it a stressor, is a good quality to have in the system, right? So that's exactly what it is to be anti-fragile, right? It precisely allows, in the same way, and I discussed this in the book, in the same way that there are now immunotherapies that try to introduce, say, a food allergen so that the body can build a resistance against it. I mean, that's what a vaccine does too,
peanut
right?
Allergy.
So exactly. So anti-fragility is something that is terribly important to have as we navigate through the trials and tribulations of life. if you sanitize everything, that's not good for your system. And by the way, I give a great another great example, if I may say so, in the book. I wish I had thought of that analogy, but it was another guy who beat me to it. There's a neuropsychiatrist who used the principle from, it's called the hygiene hypothesis. The idea is that if you look at, for example, kids who suffer from respiratory ailments, they're much more likely to come from environments that were very antiseptic, right? Mm. Precisely because their immune system weren't triggered to respond properly to these potential allergens. So if you've grown up with pets or on a farm where it's a bit more messy and dirty, you're less likely to have asthma, right? By the way, just as an anecdote, my mother was or is an OCD cleaning person, and I suffered from asthma from a very young age. Now, this doesn't mean that it's not definitive, but it's certainly anecdotal. Well, the analogy then is, our capacity to engage in critical thinking requires us to face, just like the immune system has to be triggered by allergens, my ability to think has to be triggered by being exposed to ideas that are not consistent within my little antiseptic echo chamber. That's how I learn to be a thinker. Right. That's how I learned to develop the nomological network, because I had all these asshole social scientists who rejected biology. It forced me to develop this rigorous methodology. So by the same logic, when you are creating trigger warnings, safe spaces, and all the rest of that bullshit, you are literally being anti-Darwinian in our capacity to think.
Yeah, I often think about, when I was growing up, I wished I was taller. I'm 5'8". Okay, 5'7" now at age 65, I've shrunk a little bit, I guess. And, I could tell early on that women like tall men. And then the studies turned out to show that, taller guys make more money, they get better jobs, they have better looking spouses or sexual partners and more sexual partners. And now I'm not claiming I'm a victim of my genes, my short genes, but the point is so what? What am I going to do? Well, I'm going to just date women that are slightly shorter than me, because if they like taller men, then I'm taller than them. in other words, a workaround, exactly, what you're given. Now, I'm not claiming that being, a little on the short side is the same as being black or whatever. I recognize there are certainly differences there, but that's not important. I'm not even challenging that. I'm just saying, what are you going to do with it, given those facts? Where do you go from there?
There is something you could do to it, by the way. Let me mention it. And by the way, what I'm about to answer led to a set of studies that I did, which regrettably I've yet to publish, but hopefully I will publish soon. So there is a fantastic study that looked at what happens to the perception of people as a function of having a guy be introduced with different academic status. So in condition one of the experiment, I bring in somebody into the class. This is Joe Smith. He is a postdoc. In the second version, this is Joe Smith. He's whatever, assistant professor. And I keep increasing his rank. And one of the main things that they wanted to see is what happens to his perception, his height perception, how tall he is as a function. Now, his height didn't change. They didn't make him wear heels. So objectively, nothing should change. But guess what happened, Michael? As his academic status went up, he became taller.
That's really funny.
Now, as you know, I also suffer from height challenges. Yeah. But as I always tell people who are willing to listen, and as you, I think, could attest, I have a very beautiful wife, so it's not true that shorter guys can't get beautiful women. I've never had a problem attracting beautiful women. That's because I always joke that my wife is actually dating a 6'4" guy, if you recognize what my status is. So the fact that the genes have not been kind to me when it comes to height, I can compensate for it. Mating is a compensatory process. Yes, all other things equal, if I am tall and a famous professor and a crown prince and a billionaire, it's better than not being those things. But because it is compensatory, what does compensatory mean? If I'm not doing well on one attribute, I can compensate by doing well on another attribute. So if you are a short guy, don't be apathetic and lazy and unemployed, because then you are doomed to a life of celibacy. But if you are charming and you are funny and you are hardworking, you actually might get a lot more. Pablo Picasso had a long, long lineup of gorgeous women wanting to mate with him. He was very short, shorter than both of us, ugly, fat, bald, not good looking in the least bit, but he had more women than you and I could ever count because he was Pablo Picasso.
But he didn't break Wilt Chamberlain's record.
He did. Although I have calculated that number, and it seems suspect.
I think what was the number? 20,000 or 10,000? Whatever it was, it would be like two a day for his whole life.
And basically, I calculated, as someone who in the past has suffered from bronchitis, where it would take me out for 2 weeks at a time, I'd be super sick. If he had bronchitis one time and he wasn't able to perform for the next 2 weeks, then he'd have a lot of catching up to do. So I take the 20,000 with a grain of salt.
I would too. Yes. Yeah, I do recall when in high school, when I was first starting thinking about those things and talking to girls and all that, I was pretty geeky looking, but I was kind of athletic, but I wasn't very big. But at one point, one of the girls said something like, "I really like smart guys, and I could tell you're really smart." And I went, "Oh, okay, so I can kind of nurture the smartness appearance, and maybe that'll make up for the lack of other things that I had." Anyway, I mean, but really, if you think about how lives turn out and what it means to be successful and how to do that, you know, 99.9% of jobs that are available, I can't do. I mean, I'm not good at quantum physics or whatever. I just, you know, most things I can't do. I'm not very good at most physical jobs as well. So, you know, the key is just to find the one you're good at that you also enjoy and then kind of pursue that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't want to get off on that. So I wanted to ask you about the, you know, Popper's open society and the paradox of tolerance. That is to say, if we nurture a tolerant society, an open society, which we tolerate everybody, including the intolerant people, you know, the argument, then the intolerant people are going to get a toehold. And they'll outcompete the tolerant people just by virtue of how they structure society and censor people and control things and gain more and more power. And pretty soon you'll just have a totally intolerant society. So what's your answer to the paradox of tolerance?
So I think that as long as everybody agrees to adjudicate the battle between the various camps using accepted rules, then we might be able to tolerate some intolerable things. The problem, as you said, is that when they get power, then they dismantle those things that we all agree are the means by which we adjudicate. So it is a paradox that Popper referred to precisely because it is a difficult problem. My view is no, there are certain things that are so intolerable that in the pursuit of being understanding and tolerant, no, we should not tolerate them. I actually argue that to be, you know, indiscriminately tolerant is to be barbaric, because we've evolved the emotional and moral calculus to judge. And as a matter of fact, if you remember, I have a section in my book, in the last chapter, where I talk about the old canard of, well, who am I to judge? I don't judge others. Who are we to judge? You know, and so on, right? Don't throw rocks into a glass house, all that bullshit, right? So the reality is we judge all the time. I belong to the society of judgment and decision-making, right? It's a scientific society. So we judge. It is okay to judge. The problem is when you judge, but you are being a moral hypocrite. I judge others for being philanderers, but then turns out that I do it much more than they do, right? So it was in this sense that the religious edict of don't judge, don't be a moral hypocrite, right? But to judge is to be human, right? So no problem. I don't tolerate any belief system that says you could take women and put them in bags to remove their identity. Why should I tolerate that? I don't tolerate that women should not have sexual pleasure, and so therefore let's cut off their clitorises. I don't need to tolerate that. And there's a great story that I recount of a common friend of ours, of Sam Harris. Do you know where I'm going with this? Do you remember the passage in the book?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
About moral relativism. Yeah. So this is he was having a debate with someone at some, I mean, people can look when they get the book, they could look at the exact reference where it was from, where he is interacting with a bioethicist who I think had just been appointed to serve on President Obama's commission, whatever. And she was very much of a cultural relativist. Who are we to judge? It's not fair to judge others and so on. And he said something to her to the effect of, so if there were a society that said every fourth child should have its eyes gouged so that it could walk towards the light, right? And what did she say? Well, if that's their religion, then who am I? Right. So she didn't have the innate moral compass, the innate deontological ethics to say, no, you cannot take every fourth child and gouge their eyes. She didn't have the confidence to proclaim that position because she was parasitized by the idea pathogen of cultural relativism. Yeah. So no, we don't have to. So to answer your question, I don't have to tolerate the intolerance.
Now, on that particular question, as you know, most philosophers and scientists adhere to the naturalistic fallacy that it is ought. You can't derive an ought from an is. And the way things are doesn't mean that's the way things should be, and so forth. Now, a few of us, you mentioned Sam, myself, I think Steven Pinker probably, think that there are moral values that we are essentially discovering about morality, real moral principles based on human nature. And, you know, I make this argument in several places, and, you know, most philosophers say, no, you have not really debunked the naturalistic fallacy. So it's one thing to say, you know, Western values are better than other values because why? Because free speech or individual bodily autonomy or whatever the values are that we cherish, at some point you're going to hit an epistemological wall with most philosophers and scientists who will say, you cannot say that's objectively better or absolutely better. It's just what we think now at the 21st century in the Western world, we think these values are better than those values, you know, forcing women to wear a cloth bag, for example. Setting aside that, you know, maybe they want to wear that, in which case we would say, okay, if you really are making that decision individually, then of course we'll respect that. But you're talking about something else that's kind of forced, female genital mutilation. We can assume that the women themselves don't want that. In other words, we're collecting data saying, you know, how many of you want this to happen? Now, there's always the problem of you know, surveys like that where they're saying what they think they're supposed to say, or the man's on the other side of the door and he's going to beat her if she says the wrong thing. You know, we can't trust that. But so I'm assuming that there's certain things that are objectively better about democracy versus autocracy, freedom versus slavery. In the same way, it's better to be satiated rather than hungry or starving and so forth. But how do you address this? Yeah, but at some point, you know, your fellow philosophers and scientists are going to say, no, Gad, you cannot absolutely say that it's better.
Yeah. Well, first, they're imbeciles. They're playing mental masturbation games. We are endowed with an evolved moral calculus that allows us to make certain moral judgments. So, for example, by the way, to go to the burqa and the niqab, while she may have, if she freely chooses to cover herself in the way that she does, she has the right to do that. People also have the right to not be exposed to that in the following way. It is incontestable that we've evolved to use our dominant sense, which is vision, to be able to detect the intentions of another by reading their faces, right? So I quickly look at you. I mean, look at Paul Ekman, the eminent psychologist who spent his career studying micro cues of the face, right? So when I go to a playground, this, by the way, came up during my chat on Sam Harris's show, where a bunch of truly naturally lobotomized imbeciles wrote about how, you know, Islamophobic I was, because I was recounting a story of my then very young daughter. She must have been two or three. We didn't have any other children at the time. And we were going to taking her to a local park to play. And in the middle of the park, we're standing these, you know, bunch of what ostensibly you would think are women, but I can't tell, in complete black, you know, niqabs and burqas and or burqas. And everybody was so jarred, including my daughter, that we got back into the car. And these Western imbeciles then start saying, my God, what an idiot. How could he think that that's bad? So you think walking into a playground with cloths I don't know if these are pedophiles. I don't know if they are male murderers. I don't know anything other than people are walking in black robes as ghosts. That's not jarring. That is consistent with evolutionary principles. Or is it anti-evolution in that I can't even read your face? I can't know if you're masturbating at the sight of my daughter because I can't see you under this robe. So to those philosophers who are pontificating nonsense, no, I judge. There are absolute moral truths.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if that goes as far as say they're imbeciles, because it's pretty much every philosopher I've ever met, you know, people we know and scientists, they almost all agree at some point you're inserting a Western value that is not object, it's not discovered, like planets traveling in elliptical orbits, not perfectly circular orbits, that there are no more values that are the equivalent of that. Now, I disagree with that, but most people think I'm wrong to say that. And, and to say like slavery's freedom's better than slavery, absolutely. That's kind of the low-hanging fruit. You know, I'm not sure I could say a regressive tax is objectively better than a progressive tax. You know, at some point.
So give me an example that they would use that's not as obvious as slavery is bad.
Maybe the burqa. Can... So like, for example, the counter argument might be in the Muslim world, Western women running around in bikinis, given the male, the so-called male gaze, given the male psychology, our evolved psychology, and how visual we are and what seeing that does, it's better for our culture if the women were covered up. Don't run around half naked because it causes the men to go crazy.
I have no patience for this kind of nonsense. I'm going to draw a humorous Gad analogy. You know what also solves brain cancer? The decapitation of a person. If I decapitate people, I guarantee you they will have no neurological problems. That's called progressive preventive decapitation, okay. Right? Therefore, yes, I could stop the visual male gaze, the predatory visual male gaze, by removing the identity of women. Yeah, no, that's not very convincing. If that's the best that our fancy philosopher friends can come up with, I'm winning this debate.
What about surveys in Muslim communities where the women say, I like wearing the burqa. This is what I prefer.
There's a couple of things. So it could well be that she's been so inculcated within that system that she doesn't, right? I mean, if I take an ant, the ant cannot recognize the scale of the Empire State Building because it just operates at a different unit of analysis. So if I was born into a culture where that has been, that if you don't do this, you're a whore and so on, then it's not terribly surprising and it doesn't require a fancy psychologist to understand why she might feel that. It is very, very difficult for me to believe, and as someone who comes from the Middle East, who also knows a lot of women who were in burqas and then they were freed, it's very difficult perceptually, sensorially, psychologically, cognitively, to assume that there is any currency by which, without the inculcation of the society telling you that this is what you should do, where someone would prefer to be under a black robe that doesn't allow you to breathe properly or see more than not having it. It's simply a nonsensical argument. So I don't buy it.
So it's probably yet another cultural tradition that derives from men's attempt to control female sexuality. And that would be an anti-Western value.
100%.
What about, just curious, since we're on...
As a matter of fact, I was just going to say, there's a bit of a lag, so sorry if I seem to be interrupting you. I always argue that the most threatening force in nature, it's not tsunamis, it's not hurricanes, it's not tornadoes, it's called female sexuality. Nothing is scarier than female sexuality. So men, and by the way, this is actually what a real feminist should be saying, what I'm about to say here. So men will concoct endless cultural and religious norms to try to tame female sexuality, right? I'm unaware of a major religion where the preferred god is very, very concerned about male sexuality. But very, very different traditions all seem to converge to really caring about hiding women's hair and women's breasts and women's asses and so on.
I'm curious what you think about polygamy and prostitution. You know, as a libertarian or classical liberal or whatever label, you know, I've often thought, you know, consenting adults should do whatever they want. But, you know, when you really look into these polygamous communities, say in Utah, and these girls are raised from the earliest age that you are going to be a sister wife and, you know, you're going to marry that old guy down the road and so forth. You know, by the time they're surveyed when they're 18 or 20 or whatever, they go, oh, yeah, I love being a sister wife. This is what I want to do. I'm free to do what I want to do. Mind your own business. But, you know, so I used to think, yeah, I should mind my own business. She can do whatever she wants. But on the other hand, is she really making a rational decision based on, you know, all the options available that are best for her?
No, she's not. And here I'll draw an analogy. I can't remember if we've ever discussed this before, but it's worth repeating even if we have. So when you look at advertising to children as an ethical issue, right? The typical argument is that you should only be allowed to target children in advertisements if the children have reached a cognitive developmental stage that allows them to know of the persuasive intent of the advertiser, because then they could build the cognitive defenses. I know you're trying to sell me something, Michael, and I could counter argue it in my head. But below a certain age, I don't know that. And therefore, my brain is too easily influentiable, and therefore, you shouldn't be allowed to target me. Now, so I'm not allowed to target you to sell you cereals or to sell you chewing gum, but guess which product I'm allowed to target you straight out of the womb? And I think you know the answer to this one. Which product is that,
Dr. Sherman? It could be the sex-related ones.
Well, or how about religion?
Oh, religion. Okay, I see where you're going with this. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. See where I'm going? So it is too dangerous and too immoral and absolutely illegal to try to sell you chewing gum before you're 12, but it is totally moral within the parental agency of the individual parent to feed you endless parasitic ideas straight from the get-go of coming out of your mother's womb. Because, bruh, religion, right? So look at the hypocrisy here. So this is why, by the way, many of these idea pathogens that I discuss in the book, postmodernism and radical feminism and so on, are now, and, you know, white fragility and the rest of the nonsense, critical race theory, now it's becoming earlier and earlier that we expose. So it started in the universities, but now it's happening in high schools, and now it's moving to elementary schools, because I got to get to that malleable brain as early as I can so I can truly parasitize you.
Yeah, again, on the related topic of prostitution, you know, I always thought, well, consenting adults, what they do in the bedroom is none of my business. But, you know, again, when you look at some of the more abusive ends of sex workers, where there's drug addiction and the pimps are physically, you know, assaulting the women and so forth, it's like, okay, they're not, and a lot of them are poor. And this is the only way they have of getting themselves out of poverty. You know, it's like, this is not a rational choice, you know, in terms of, you know, economic rational choice theory. They're not making rational choices. There's other factors going on there that perhaps the state does need to step in. If not prohibited, it certainly regulated it. But that's the worst end of it. You know, there was that Business Insider story that was going around a few weeks ago about that woman that's making $100,000 a month. Basically, she masturbates on camera for men that pay her. And she set it up in a way that you have to, like, give money, like a dollar or whatever, every minute or whatever to keep her going. And she kind of set this system up where she's just raking it in. And to me, that doesn't look abusive at all. It's like she figured it out. She's got the algorithm here that's got these guys going crazy sending money to her. But somewhere between that and the, you know, the prostitute in the inner city that's being beaten by her pimp, you know, where does the state step in to regulate or prohibit, or what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, it's a tough one. I would certainly say in the extreme negative example, that one we should have an intervention. But in the other extreme of the, I think they're called cam girls. Is that the right term? Maybe cam girls or whatever, webcam girls. I think you're exactly right. If there is absolutely no abuse, you know, coercion of any sort, then who cares, right? And incidentally, there was a study that I covered in my Psychology Today column a few years ago. I think the hypothesis scientifically, formally, is called the damaged goods hypothesis, it's very relevant to what we're talking about here. It basically argued that to the extent that women end up becoming adult film stars or actresses, that's because they are damaged goods, in quotes. Damaged goods in the sense that something must have happened in their life. They were sexually abused and so on, which, from a folk psychology perspective, it has some face validity. It seems like, yeah, that seems reasonable. Well, they tested that and they didn't find support for the damaged good hypothesis. In other words, many women simply made that, you know, if I can use the term, rational choice, because they thought that doing 3 sex scenes a month instead of working as a cashier for 8 hours a day for a whole month was a good calculus for them. And so I think that as long as there's absolutely no coercion of any type, let people do whatever they want. Who cares?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I just remembered where I got that link to that Business Insider article. It was from Claire Lehman at Quillette, because she posted it and said, gee, when I was in graduate school, I had to work as a waitress at a restaurant at $10 an hour or whatever. This woman's making $100,000 a month. You know, maybe I can understand this is a rational choice.
Now she's gotten into some hot troubles recently. I haven't been following her very closely. There's a porn star. Her name is Mercedes Carrera, who I truly did not know who she was, because people say, yeah, sure, you didn't know. I didn't know who she was, but apparently she's a pretty well-known porn star who I had seen on one or two shows. She was very, very well-spoken. She was an engineer, I think, by training. So early on my show, on The Sad Truth, I had invited her for a chat. And if any of you want to go back and check our conversation, she certainly did not exude any cues. And I think I might have even asked her, was there anything bad in her background? And no, it was a very cold, calculated decision that her doing this would end up causing her to be in a much better financial position than any other option. And that's why she thought it was a very empowering thing.
I guess the Western principles behind this then are, is there coercion? Is there violence? Does the person have physical and mental autonomy over their choices? You know, that's kind of how we might make that decision. All right, Gad, we've been going an hour and a half. This is fantastic. I want to just wrap up with one kind of final overview of what your book is about in this sense, because I haven't made up my mind on this. How big of a problem is this that we're talking about? You know, microaggressions, safe spaces, these campus protests. On the one hand, all the examples you present in the book, I'm familiar with them. They concern me. And when I see Tucker Carlson with his weekly campus craziness stories of things like what happened at Yale University with the Halloween costumes, or what happened with Brett Weinstein at Evergreen. And so there's enough of these that you can have a weekly segment where it looks like the Academy has completely lost its mind. And to an outsider, you know, somebody reading this or watching this would, you know, think, I don't even want to go on a college campus. My God, it must just be hysteria. And yet, if you walk on a college campus, it's mostly nothing happening. So you cite statistics from FIRE, I always forget what it stands for, but the group that Greg Lukianoff's group that keeps track of all these cancellations and deplatforming and so on. You know, there's hundreds and hundreds of them, but there's 5,000 universities, and, you know, they have, let's say they each invite 10 speakers a year, you know, so you get 50,000 speakers speaking, and if only a couple hundred are canceled, that's a pretty small percentage. So I'm kind of conflicted about, is this a really serious problem, or am I ensconced in this world so much that it's a confirmation bias and outside of it, it's not that bad? I don't know. What are kind of your global thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic, fantastic question. So I'll answer it in two ways. First, it is absolutely true what you said, that if you walk on campus, it's not being overrun by blue-haired male social justice warriors, right? So if the metric that you are using to diagnose the severity of the problem is how many are there, then you would say, oh, this is no big deal, right? But then the analogy that I would draw is, I would ask someone who levies that concern or that point, is how many people did it take to bring down the Twin Towers? Was it 190,000? Was it 19 million? Was it 190 million? Oh, no, it was 19 right. people, right? So the number of people that can cause cataclysmic problems is not an indication of, the downstream effect. So that's one. So is there tons of blue-haired people on campus? No. Is this a phenomenally important set of issues? Absolutely. Why? Because each of these idea pathogens that I speak about in the parasitic mind, that's why I use the death by a thousand cuts. One issue might be okay. Two might make the society a bit more sick. Put all of the collection of commitment to have a departure from reason, from freedom, from individual dignity, from the scientific method, and then look at the downstream effects, then you get into some serious problems. So, and let me give you a specific anecdote. I receive thousands of messages from professors, from students, from parents of students, now from people in industry who have to take Thy Religion, Diversity, Inclusion, Equity seminars, where they have to say that they are such pigs because they're white, because they suffer from toxic masculinity. Is this a serious problem, or who cares? It's only about 600,000 people who've written to me. So in other words, the ethos that makes our society great and that doesn't make Lebanon, the one that I escaped from, not great, is that it has a protective belt of values that allows us to flourish. Mm-hmm. The attacks don't come in a minute or in a week, but then you wake up in 100 years and you go, what's happened? So, yes, you could still walk on campus without being accosted by Antifa and blue-haired people. But if you extrapolate to where we're going, it is a deathly important problem.
Perfectly said, Gad said. The Parasitic Mind, How Infectious Ideas Are Killing Common Sense. I love the book. I think it's an important book. I hope it's widely read, especially the last chapter, where it's kind of a call to action, and it ends in an optimistic, upbeat note, like we can defeat these ideas. I'm glad you're out there doing it. Keep it up on social media. You are a real champion out there.
Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you so much. Cheers.